November is fast approaching, and in a few months, Americans will decide who their next leader will be, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. This campaign has been fraught with drama, as Trump has made a number of outrageous comments, like calling for an end to Muslim migration. His nomination as the Republican candidate has shocked many commentators who never expected him to be this popular. But when it comes to the rise of populism, Australia has a lot more in common with America than people might think. At least according to Linda Torrado, a US writer and activist who's visiting Australia. Linda has been fighting against inequality and racism ever since a blog she wrote about living in poverty went viral. She spoke to me about her thoughts on what drives people to vote the way they do.
My argument is that people inherently vote for their interests that they perceive. So if you think people are voting against their interests, you need to stop and take a look at their perceptions and why that might be that case. So, for example, why do people vote Republican is the common, like, oh, there's all these poor folk voting Republican. We know Republicans are going to gut all of these social programs. We know they're, you know, very free market trickle down people. But they haven't stopped to realize that under the Democrats, we don't feel an awful lot of that recovery on the bottom either. And so from the perspective of somebody who's a casual worker, has two or three jobs, isn't making it, whichever party's in charge doesn't really matter to them on economic grounds because those gains aren't going to be felt across the system. But if they happen to be personally socially conservative or religious, then it actually makes perfect sense for them to vote for folks who are going to come together on that issue. The thing that I used to hear a lot in Utah, which is a very religious state, and it's the one I'm from, was that it's not worth the possibility of maybe being able to go to a doctor in 3 or 4 years if it means that we're going to legalize abortion and make that access more broad. Now, personally, I'm pro-choice as wide as the day is long, but I do understand that some people feel that kind of, you know, moral compunction about it. And so they perceive their interests to be those social issues instead of the economic ones because they don't really see a big enough difference to kind of outweigh that on the economic scale.
When it comes to Trump specifically, many people are shocked that he's been nominated as the Republican candidate, and his popularity is often explained as being driven by economic and social anxiety. What do you think about that?
I think the data doesn't actually bear that out. What we're finding is that Trump has most of his popularity amongst seniors and amongst the kind of lower middle classes. So what everybody's everybody wants to say it's uneducated white males, but that's not actually what the data show us. His popularity, I think, is largely based on people who really, really, really hate Hillary Clinton after 30 years of hearing, you know, horrific things about her. Like, look, I've got my critiques of Hillary. I'm not a Hillary supporter by any stretch, but a lot of the opposition to her is based on absolutely made up fabrications and pretty big smear campaigns. Like, she probably hasn't killed anybody personally. But if you go to the Republican base, you'll find a lot of people who think that not only Barack Obama isn't still a citizen, but that Hillary Clinton personally murdered Vince Foster. So it's really hard to call this election because it's the crazy season.
In Australia, we're seeing the rise of Pauline Hanson, and we now have 4 One Nation senators, which is a lot of influence in government. Do you think that there are similarities between the populism of Trump and Hanson and others like them?
They're exactly the same. And you could also add Farage and Boris Johnson, you know, all of the men that gave in to Brexit and then resigned. That populist resurgence, though, we need to separate economic populism from that kind of xenophobic native populism. One Nation voters are blaming their economic troubles for their xenophobia and their nationalism, and they get them mixed up. And I think that the frightening thing about seeing the resurgence of One Nation is that when you allow that sort of speech to get equal time and equal play in the media just because they're there, that's how you wind up with Trump. It's fantastic that Pauline Hanson is allowed to run. You can't stop freedom of expression and you can't stop political ideas. You can laugh at them from up front and say, no, it's frankly ridiculous to say anything about Muslims as a category because there's like 1.3 billion of them in the entire world. It's frankly ridiculous to say anything about indigenous people as a category because you're talking about folks that are spread out across an entire continent who have been treated very disparately by the government over the course of years. So you get things like in the Northern Territories, you had Don Dale, right? And essentially, that's story is a bunch of grown men could not handle children who had kind of, the one kid had kind of broken because he was kept in solitary for long enough that it would violate the Geneva Conventions if this was a time of war. And a whole group of grown men felt like the only way to deal with that situation was to tear gas other caged children. And the fact that you've got people supporting that. Listen, I used to work in youth detention, all right? If you get a kid that won't stop yelling and cursing, you remind yourself that you're an adult. You don't torture the 11-year-old, right? So to make any excuse for that is kind of mind-boggling to me. And yeah, it is the rise of Trump, the rise of Hansen and, you know, Scott Morrison and Corey Bernardi and that whole crew of folks that are, we are going to blame this other. Giving that idea airtime is what created Donald Trump.
And do you think this idea that fear makes people do or believe illogical and unreasonable things, is that what is sort of allowing people who maybe previously wouldn't be swayed by Trump or Hansen to believe what they say without checking the facts or without questioning it?
Anytime you get progress, you're going to get a backlash, right? So we made huge advances in women's rights in the 80s. And today, a woman from America actually medaled in the Olympics, and she's married to a pro football player. And the headline was, wife of pro football player gets medal in Olympics, right? And so that sort of backlash happens. We see great racial advances, and then we see a whole lot of hatred coming out. We make huge advances in gay rights, and then all of a sudden it's gay bashing time, right? So there's always going to be that kind of anger. I think that the fear that they are playing on is because people don't know what they're afraid of. We have all this increasing globalization and technology. Like, suddenly in America, you know, there's 318 million people, right? So if two people get shot every day, that's actually a vanishingly small percentage. But because we hear about every single incident that happens, we're suddenly afraid that there's this influx of, you know, individual incidents, where really it's happening kind of at the same rate it was before, at least overall. And so what they're doing is going, you're afraid of something. Here, let me give you a locus or a loci and a focus for that fear. Let me tell you who to be afraid of. There's a great song by Sage Francis called Makeshift Patriot about the towers coming down on 9/11. And one of the lines is, we don't know who the culprit is yet, but he looks like this. You know, let us give you that thing. And then people just kind of go with it because nobody else is talking to them. You find me where Labor's actually, and the Greens and all of these leftist parties are going up to where the miners are and going, hey, guys, we totally should have been on retraining and coming up with a plan B for you about 15 years ago. We dropped that ball. We're sorry. But you're workers and we're on your side. Instead, you hear an awful lot of folks going, get over it. That's a dying industry. And I'm like, but there's thousands of Australian families that are being affected by this, right? So who are they supposed to listen to? The people who come to them and say, we know why you're afraid and we have a thing you can fight. We've got a battle you can wage. There's something that you can do about your situation. Or folks that go, there's literally nothing you can do about it. Just accept it and move on with no kind of course forward.
And so does the media have a certain responsibility in situations like this where the climate of fear dominates?
Yes, and unfortunately, the Fourth Estate has so spectacularly abrogated their responsibilities that I hesitate to call them media anymore. Look, I'm a night cook from rural Utah that happens to be a journalist now, but it's not been that many years. You have an option when they invite you on TV whether or not you want to take that panel. You have an option when they ask you to write an article to say no. You can go, I don't believe in this, I think this is harmful, and just choose not to. There's a quote in Harry Potter in the fifth book when Rita Skeeter is talking to Hermione, right? And she goes, don't you have a responsibility to tell the truth? Doesn't the paper exist to tell the truth? And Skeeter goes, no, the paper exists to sell itself, you silly girl. And it's that over and over and over. I think the media has a responsibility to be better. But unfortunately, we forget about that frequently in favor of what's right.
That was Linda Tirado, a US writer and activist who's visiting Australia